We have a lot we want to talk about today. We'll start with my good friend Rick Britton, local author, celebrated historian, award-winning celebrated local author. His books include A Monticello Sampler and what am I missing?
Virginia Vignettes.
Virginia Vignettes, of course.
And Albemarle in Charlottesville and Illustrated History.
I was looking at that the other day, as a matter of fact.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's right near my desk. It was... You know, it's one of those key books I like to grab every once in a while. I know Rick wrote about that. Where is that?
I'm glad you consider it a key book.
Yeah, I do. So, there's so much to talk about. You and I haven't talked in months.
That's right.
Let's begin with, I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving at your house.
Had a great Thanksgiving. And you?
Yeah, it was okay.
Yeah.
I'm not a big Thanksgiving guy, so...
How come?
Don't know. I'm trying to remember. It was never a big gathering thing. I mean, it was for a few years when my brother was married to his former wife, and we would gather up at his place, and there was a lot of poker, and there was some fun things to it, yeah. But not so much anymore.
Maybe you need to reintroduce poker.
I do enjoy poker. I really, really do enjoy poker. It's fun, yeah. I never win big, but it's so much fun to sit there with guys you've known since you were a kid.
A few adult beverages.
And sit there. Well, they do, yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
And to sit there for, like, you know, 10 hours. 8-10 hours. And,
oh, wow.
And just
That's
eat.
A marathon.
Oh, yeah. It's so much fun to eat and just play poker and have a good time. Oh, yeah. All night. It's so much fun.
I've never done that.
You never have done that? If you
not
play poker?
For 8 or 10. I've played poker, but not for 8 or 10 hours. I mean, that's
fun.
Like right out of the movies.
Yeah. It's fun. Have you been to Vegas? Do you do the...
I've never been to Vegas. Have you been to Vegas?
I've never been. I've never wanted to go.
Yeah. I'm not interested in going to Vegas.
No. Aside from knowing the Virginia Civil War battlefields like the back of your hand, have you been a big traveler? Have you, don't think I've ever, where have you been in the world?
Well, growing up, my dad got transferred just about every year. So up through, I probably told you this before, but up through high school, up through 12th grade, I went to 10 different schools. So we lived all over the country while I was growing up.
What did he do again?
Well, he was a salesman, and then he became a sales manager.
He was running from the law, wasn't he? You could tell us.
mostly in plastics, you know, just like that famous scene from The Graduate. He was into plastics and became a sales manager, then a plant manager, and, you know, just moving up the ladder. And we got transferred all over the place. He worked for a lot of different companies, DuPont, Owens Corning Fiberglass, you know, a lot of those big companies. So we lived all over the country and then in Latin America, too. So
that's right. Yeah.
I spent a bunch of time when I was little in Argentina outside of Buenos Aires. In fact, Victoria and I, my wife and I, were just there a couple of weeks ago for an entire week visiting my mom. My mom is from there. And then I graduated high school in São Paulo, Brazil.
So you grew up speaking Spanish and Portuguese.
Spanish and Portuguese.
Because a lot of Americans may not know. They don't really speak Spanish in Brazil. It was settled by the Portuguese.
That's right. That's right.
Right?
Right. Actually, first settled by the Dutch. And then the Portuguese threw the Dutch out of Brazil.
Really?
Yeah.
The Dutch and their ships. They were in New York, too.
The Dutch were everywhere. Yeah.
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 So most unforgettable place in South America. Like the one place where if you could... You could go back to and just sit there and be there. Where is it?
Oh, my gosh. Well, there's so many, but the two most amazing cities are Buenos Aires, which is just gorgeous, and Rio. What Rio has in Brazil, very few other cities in the world have. You have the beaches and the mountains in one place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sort of like Santa Barbara, California, I'm thinking of.
Yeah. But
or even LA has a little bit of that.
Yeah, but I mean, these are big mountains.
Yeah, these are real mountains.
Right behind the city, and then they're the beaches. So it's just incredibly beautiful.
What are the people like?
The people are very warm, very outgoing.
Do they like those Americans?
They like Americans, sure.
But not too much. There's a little hesitation in your voice.
Bring money.
Oh, yeah. You mean they like money?
Yeah, bring your money, bring the dollars. Yeah, yeah. No, they're incredible. The Latin people are just very friendly, very outgoing.
And Rio is a real international city. It's like New York, right?
I mean, it's not just it's huge.
It's not just Brazilians. It's people from all over the world.
Right. Now there's a lot of poverty, and some of it will just you turn a corner and you end up in this one spot, and it's just gut wrenching to see, and it's upsetting. I saw a lot of that in Buenos Aires too. But, you know, we have it here now on the street corners.
Yeah. So you grew up speaking Spanish and Portuguese and English.
Right.
Which is harder to learn, Spanish or the Portuguese? And am I saying it right? The Portuguese.
Yeah.
You got the little accent there.
Yeah, Portuguese.
Is that what they said? Portuguese.
Portuguese. But actually, the brand of Portuguese that I speak is Brasileiro. So the difference between Brazilian and Portuguese is the same as the difference between American and British.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And it's the same in Argentina. In Argentina, they speak Castellano, and the difference between Castellano and Spanish from Spain is the same as the difference between American and a lot of difference.
There you go.
Yeah. And you can tell. Most people who are speakers can tell right away, which is really neat. Spanish speakers can tell right away what country somebody is from.
By their accent.
By their accent. And the certain words that they use that are different. Yeah, it's really neat.
But you could go to Spain, right? And you could still...
Yeah, I could get along.
You could get around.
But they would recognize me as a colonial.
And you could do the same in Portugal, too.
I could, but they would recognize me as a colonial.
Have you been there?
I haven't been there, but
my sister went there
there
one time,
yeah,
and she said it's
fantastic.
She said, everybody I've talked to who's been to Portugal said it's the most beautiful place in Europe.
I've got to go.
But you don't hear Americans mentioning it that much.
That's right. That's why it's the nicest place in Europe.
Well, I'm glad you had a wonderful Thanksgiving, Rick Britton.
Thank you.
So you said you went and you saw Hacksaw Ridge. Let's talk movies really quick.
I did, just a few nights ago. And it was over at Stonefield and in that, you know, amazing theater they've got with a stadium seating. And
was it the IMAX theater?
Yeah. And it's fantastic. I mean,
I think that's Theater 6, if I'm not mistaken.
As a fan of war movies and as a military historian, I grew up watching war movies. I watched all of them. I would put Hacksaw Ridge right there with Saving Private Ryan.
Really?
And Band of Brothers.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'd love to see it.
So I think it's really worth seeing.
I'm limited in that I see what my son wants to see.
And he doesn't want to see it?
And for those who don't know, my son has autism, and that's what we do together. He really loves to go see movies. He lives to go see movies. He is happiest in a movie theater. So he and I go almost every single week.
Wow.
To see a movie of his choice.
That's great.
That's what we do together. And that's what he loves. And so he sort of picks the movies. I did get him to go see Allied because I really wanted to see that. And he didn't
that.
At first. So I'll tell you about that in a minute. But I said that because I'd love to see Hacksaw Ridge too. And he's like, no. He'll say that's silly. He said, oh, that's silly. No, we're not going to see that. What's it about?
People who are interested in seeing it should be warned ahead of time. It's some of the most brutal and violent combat scenes I've ever seen. So
Hacksaw Ridge.
Yeah. So there
more
are,
than Saving Private Ryan.
There are a number of scenes that are the same caliber, or even more brutal and violent than that opening scene in Saving Private Ryan when the guys are landing at Omaha. But I think that's valuable because it really gives you an appreciation for what these poor guys went through.
Well, and realism, or an effort at realism. If you look at the history of cinema, and if you want to look out, if you really want to talk about this, we can, but if you look out into the future, that's where we're going. We're going towards, you know, virtual reality, simulation.
True.
I mean, if you look at the history of cinema, we're only making it more and more real to our senses, and we're going to get to the point where you are standing on the beach, and you are experiencing
it. That's a good point.
Through your eyes and your ears and tactile, and you're looking around, and
Yeah.
Of course that's coming.
Yeah, I would argue, and I appreciate what you're saying, and I agree. I would argue that we're going in both directions. We're going more realistic and more fantastical, because I could never have imagined 20 years ago all of the superhero movies that we have nowadays. Honestly, you and me and the lamppost, I don't understand the superhero
movies.
The
whole movies. Marvel franchise?
I don't get it at all.
There are a ton of them, aren't there?
Yeah.
I wonder why that is.
It's a good question. I think the generation, which I believe is my generation, that grew up on the comic books, a lot of those guys just never stopped reading the comic books, and now they're directors and producers.
Yeah. I don't know. Hey, you watch Westworld on HBO?
No, I haven't watched Westworld.
It's amazing.
Yeah?
It's beyond amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm actually thinking about teaching a class on it.
Wow.
Because it's just so thought-provoking.
We have been binge-watching The Walking Dead.
I saw a few of those episodes and stopped. And I'll tell you why. And then I want to hear your response to this.
Okay.
It was like soap opera zombies.
It is. It's a soap opera with zombies.
Yeah.
But here's the difference.
It got boring to me.
Yeah, and I understand that some of the episodes are
Yeah.
But The acting is really good. There's a lot of character development. And later on in the show, if you get into the later on episodes, and spoiler alert here, the zombies aren't the threat.
Oh, was it other people?
It's the other people. It's the gangs of other people. Yeah. So in a way,
we need that to mix it up.
Yeah. In a way, I was telling my wife about this morning. It was a kind of a lot like Clockwork Orange in that there are gangs everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And they're fighting each other. Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. Zombies aren't the threat anymore.
Hacksaw Ridge, is it based on a true story kind of thing?
It is based on a true story, and I looked it up, and I was not aware of this story at all. It's a it's about a conscientious objector, Desmond Doss.
From
Lynchburg.
I saw the trailer. Yeah, I know what it is now.
It's amazing.
And he goes into war without a gun, right?
Oh, yeah. He refuses to even touch a weapon, and he ends up in a rifle company, and initially there are all these problems, but I don't want to tell everybody what happens.
Is he a medic? Did that what they?
He becomes a medic.
You would think that would be the job they'd give him.
He becomes
as long as you're here, you know, carry some medicine.
He becomes a medic. Yeah, it's an amazing story.
And it's based on a true story. This real guy.
Yeah,
from Virginia.
The very next day, I looked it up and I read all about him on the internet, and the movie is pretty accurate. They're pretty close to real.
Wow. All right, I got to see this.
Yeah, you should see it.
I got to convince Whitman to go see it. We did go see this past weekend. We did see Allied, which opened this past weekend.
What's that about?
It's World War II, Casablanca, London, spy meets another spy, and they get married, and then they come to him and say, hey, we think your wife is a spy for the Germans.
Oh, right.
Really, really good.
Okay, I'll go see that.
But it's I didn't like Brad Pitt's performance, but he's hit or miss anyway. But what I did like is the whole time I'm sitting there thinking, like, I felt like I was watching a Hitchcock movie. It's that good. But you have to go ready to watch, like, a classic kind of thriller. It's
which
not a thriller
it's slower,
from...
Which means it's
slower. It's a little slower. The pacing is a little more like out of the 40s or 50s. But I liked that because I love Hitchcock, and it felt like a Hitchcock.
Yeah.
And it's
Hitchcock
so too. Suspenseful. I mean, really, really... It's a great movie.
Like Casablanca, huh?
Yes. Yeah.
What's your favorite line out of Casablanca?
Oh,
the most famous one?
I don't know. I've only seen it once.
Oh, my gosh. I've seen it probably a dozen times.
Have you really?
Yeah. You remember Paris. You wore blue. The Germans wore gray.
We also saw Moana, which is the new animated Disney movie about the about Hawaii or the South Pacific Islanders. And that's beyond good. Best animated film of the year.
Oh, wow.
Kubo and the Two Strings is a close second, which is was very good. See, you don't see these animated movies.
I don't see these animated
movies.
I see all
of the animated movies.
You can tell
movies.
By the look on my face that I have no idea.
I see them all. And hands down, Moana is, and it's a musical, but definitely worth seeing if you enjoy those kind of things or you have kids in your life, grab them and go. They'll love it. It really is good.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's the music was done by the guy who did the music
For Hamilton.
For Hamilton. What's your thoughts on that?
I haven't heard the music from Hamilton.
Well, what's your thoughts on the idea that Hamilton is being rediscovered in this new era and painted in this light that's very, very favorable, which for those Jeffersonians among us, for me, that's a bit of a shock and just shows how much they don't really know him.
That's a problem.
Because he's a hard guy to paint in a favorable light as far as I'm concerned.
That's a hard thing for me, too. As a fellow Jeffersonian, you knew the answer to that.
I did.
Yeah.
But
to see both of those guys singing rap would probably also be a big problem for me. But then, you know, I'm picky about stuff like that. I'm incredibly picky. For example, they used to have a play down at, there was this place in the Shenandoah Valley. What was it called? Where they used to have musicals.
Outside?
No.
It's not Limekiln Theater.
Limekiln.
Oh, yeah,
Limekiln.
In Lexington.
And I went down there to see.
I used to live about 5 miles from that place.
Okay, they had a musical on Stonewall Jackson.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I had to go see it, so I went to see it. Everybody told me, you got to go see it. And I didn't have a problem with Jeb Stuart singing and dancing, because he's more that kind of guy. But I had a big problem as soon as Stonewall Jackson was singing and dancing, because there's no way he would sing and dance. So, but I'm picky about that kind of stuff.
Hey, Rick, let me get serious here for a moment.
Okay.
What crossed your mind when you read recently and you heard about the hundreds of faculty members and students at UVA who had signed a letter to President Teresa Sullivan asking that she no longer quote Thomas Jefferson? And we should clarify, because I've talked to people who signed that letter who have told me to my face, I'm not against her quoting Jefferson. I was against her quoting Jefferson in that moment following the election of Donald Trump when so many students were upset. And the last thing they needed to, many of these students of color, the last thing they needed to hear from was some old white man being deified. That was, you know, what was said to me. And then there are other people who signed it who don't want to hear about Jefferson ever again. Faculty members at UVA. We've talked about him enough. Move on. What crossed your mind?
Well, you obviously know a whole lot more about it than I do. First thing that went through my mind is, how silly is that? Then the second thing that went through my mind when I read that there were professors is, I thought that that was...
A lot of them.
I thought that I was actually amazed that professors would actually do that. I would expect more from professors at the University of Virginia, that perhaps they would look up and research Jefferson a little bit more before they would complain about something like
and
that.
And I think in the letter,
his academical village.
One of the comments that was made by somebody who put the letter together was that she made the claim, a woman on faculty, that you can't separate the good stuff he says from the bad things he did. That's impossible.
Right. I believe in you know, when we research, when we discover historical figures, and you and I have talked about this umpteen times, it's best to try to learn about them, warts and all. And so I think you and I have a fairly good warts and all opinion of Thomas Jefferson. We can talk about the good, we can talk about the bad. But after all, he's a human being, and anybody put under that same microscope would have good and bad. All of us,
yeah.
Anybody,
yeah.
You know. So how is that?
But what about quoting him? Because you and I quote him a lot.
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
And
I think it's silly for them to ask her to not to stop quoting. I think it's just incredibly silly. And I think that another word that went through my mind, and I know you've thought about this a lot, is coddling. And I see us coddling the younger generation, and when they get out into the real world where they're no longer being coddled, it's going to be a big slap in the face. It's going to be a wake-up call to
Or, as they age into the business world, will they make the same demands in the workplace that they make at university? Will the corporation become more like the university?
No, I don't think so.
Because some might say it is with HR departments. And,
right, but I think, you know, in the workplace, people would be inclined to say, look, just grow up. You're just going to have to grow up. You're at Mr. Jefferson's academical village. You got to get used to it. You knew you were coming to Jefferson's academical village.
That's the part that gets me the most, is all the people who joined the community knowing.
Right.
But they don't like that part. They don't like that aspect of... And one of them explained it to me this way. It's deifying him to constantly quote him. It makes him superhuman and like he's this go-to knowledge.
What are they asking her to do? Are they asking her to write a biography that includes warts and all about Thomas Jefferson? If they don't want him to be deified, they can go out and read plenty of biographies that slam Thomas Jefferson. Or that talk about, you know, they could read, what's the fella, Master of the Mountain? They could go and read Weinzig if they want to. Or they can go and read some of the things by Peter Onuf. There are plenty of other places.
I got a whole chapter in my book on Jefferson about slavery.
Right. So what do they expect her to do?
Well, there was a complaint by some of the faculty members that isn't getting enough attention, to which, and again, I'm with you, I was dumbfounded because... This very president, Teresa Sullivan, is the one that appointed an entire commission to study and make recommendations so that the university could better tell its story about being complicit with human slavery.
Right.
I mean, she's the one who did that.
Right.
And she created the President's Commission on Slavery in the University. She did that. And yet they look at her and say, you're not doing enough to draw attention to the university and Thomas Jefferson's relationship to slavery. I just don't think that's factually true.
Right.
I just don't think it's accurate.
I would agree with that. So I think the whole notion is silly. And what was her reaction? Do you know?
Oh, it wasn't as strong as I would have liked, but she said, look, you know, she didn't say what's a big deal, but I don't remember the exact word she said, but she said, look, he's the founder of the university. We don't quote him in every single letter. And actually, the Kevler Daily looked at all of her statements and public addresses and everything, and she had quoted Jefferson in a fraction of a very small percentage of all her statements
there
and letters.
Very
small percentage already. So it's not like she was quoting him in every letter and public statement. And she said, look, that we can quote him without sanctioning or endorsing or embracing the horrific deeds that he was a part of. And so, you know, and I'm paraphrasing what you said.
Yeah, part of what I would say to the students and to those professors, and I am really disappointed that professors would actually sign that letter, I choose to recognize that he has good and bad, and I'm going to pick the best quotes. But we all need to recognize that this man has problems. Everybody has problems. We're all just human beings.
And I guess they might say, well, child rape and human slavery aren't just quote unquote problems. That he was, I'm being devil's advocate here.
They used the phrase child rape?
No, they did. I did.
Okay.
Because, you know, he was in his 40s and she was, what, 13, 12, 13?
Right. But to put that in
context. When that relationship started? So.
Right. But to put that in context, that was more common back then.
Okay. As was human slavery.
I'm not trying to excuse
it.
But it was much more common.
No, and even though it was more common.
Very,
then,
very young women.
But there were people who were against it even then.
Right.
That was inappropriate. So, especially that it was a girl who was his quote unquote property.
His own property.
Yeah. Right. Of course, we're talking about Sally Hemings. But,
right.
Yeah. I don't know how we got on that. But I think that some people might look at it and say, hey, you know, Rick, these aren't just problems. These aren't just human foibles. These aren't faux pas. This speaks to a truly horrific human being who never abandoned these practices throughout his life and went to his grave. And we should point out, in his old age, he told other people, don't free your slaves.
Right.
You know, don't free these people. Right. Don't let them go. And he went to his graves.
And I would argue
supporting
that
these horrors.
That's a case of presentism. What we're basically talking about is presentism. And so these people don't have the depth of knowledge of Jefferson to put him in the context where, okay, by today's standards, it's horrific, the things that we're talking about. But in his day, he was fairly progressive.
On some
for
things.
A Southern slaveholder.
Although we should point out, just to take issue with that, should point out that even at the time he was criticized as being a hypocrite.
Right.
Even in his own day. So these aren't 21st century standards judging
true.
Him. Even by his own day.
This is true. By people like Hamilton.
By people. Who, oh man, what a two-faced guy that guy was. He would go after Jefferson for being a slave owner at the same time that, as a lawyer, he would work to keep people enslaved.
Because
they had slavery in New York City, too.
I'm not a fan of Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break. It's 4:30 on the nose. We'll take a very quick break. We're talking with my great friend, award-winning and celebrated local historian and author, Rick Britton. You can find him online at rickbritton.com. You're listening to Inside Charlottesville. We'll be right back. It's 4:32 on the clock. You're listening to Inside Charlottesville. I am Coy Barefoot. Rick Britton is with me. Let me ask you about these statues, these Confederate statues. You have built much of your career writing about, studying, lecturing, teaching, touring people through Civil War battlefields. You know the story of the Civil War, especially here in Virginia, better than anyone I know. So,
except maybe Gary Gallagher.
Well, Gary Gallagher. What's your reaction to this debate now going on in Charlottesville about what to do with these Confederate monuments that, you know, they didn't go up right after the Civil War.
That's right.
Robert E. Lee went up in 1924, 60 years later.
Both of the statues went up in the
20s. Stonewall Jackson, they went up in the 20s at a time when, in that post-World War I era, we had a bit of a mini civil rights movement with a lot of
returning era.
Veterans were coming back and they wanted... They wanted the right to vote, the right to get equal jobs and equal pay, and the KKK came back to life.
It was a resurgence of the KKK.
Yeah,
at the same
and
time.
Those Civil War monuments celebrating the Confederacy went up in the 20s in places like Charlottesville, specifically as a way of saying, hey, people of color, remember where you are. Remember this land where we are. This is the Confederacy.
Sure.
So I totally understand where people are coming from when they say these monuments celebrate and venerate the U.S. Confederacy.
They do. And in a way, I really like the way you just described them and them going up that time period. In a way, that situation is very similar to the battle flag being adopted as part of state flags in the 50s and 60s as a response to civil rights.
Yeah.
It's very similar in that sense.
Yeah, because people weren't waving that Confederate battle flag so much in the 30s, for example.
That's right.
Or in the 40s. But again, after World War, you get a lot of returning veterans who've been in other places in the world, and they come back home and they say, hey, I would like a little freedom and justice in my hometown, just like I risked my life to bring to another hometown, you know, a world away.
Right.
So why can't we have it here?
Right.
And so you started seeing that Confederate flag come up and be reflown again across the South. Again, saying the same thing those statues said, specifically aimed at people of color. Hey, don't forget, this is white man's land. That was the message that many of people who supported the statues and supported the flag, that's what they were saying.
Right. I think that's right. Not everybody, but the people who are not aware of what they represent to the African-American community and other oppressed communities, the people who are not aware of that are still complicit in presenting that kind of horrific point of view.
So Charlottesville created this commission to study it, and it looks like they've sort of, to borrow a pun here, they've raised a flag and released a preliminary recommendation that has so far gotten some favorable reaction, I think, from a lot of people, to leave the statues, but to add a lot more signage explaining what we're talking about, so that the statues become less a symbol of celebration and veneration.
Right. Right.
But is that even possible?
I think that's possible. This is something you and I talked about, months ago, maybe last year, when this first came up here in town.
Yep.
With this Blue Ribbon Commission. I think it's possible. Now, that doesn't help an African-American family. And this is something that was described to me, a situation that I hadn't thought of. An African-American family, and they're thinking of moving here to town, and they drive by and they see Confederate iconography, Confederate
statue. They see the old South, Rick.
And they're not close enough to read this additional signage that contextualizes it. It doesn't help them any because they see the old South. Yeah, but I think that would be beneficial. And we talked about this. I think one of the main reasons that they're not going to take them down is it's just too darn expensive to do that. So I would put up this. If it was up to me, I would put up signage to contextualize it. I give tours. I give Civil War tours of Charlottesville and Albemarle pretty frequently now because I'm working for a local tour group. And I tell people that this statuary is just as emblematic of the 1920s as it is of the 1860s.
Absolutely.
So,
if not more so.
I think that a viable thing would be to change the names of the parks, put up signage to contextualize those statues, and then put up statues of local civil rights leaders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd love to see a statue to the children of the civil rights movement, because to me they're truly the unsung heroes.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Of those kids who got up and went to school and were literally on the front lines of the civil rights movement,
sure,
integrating the schools. They're the ones who, not their parents, they're the ones who took the seats in the classrooms day after day after day, everybody watching them. Always on the, I mean, you know, I've seen interviews with these people who are like, you can't imagine the stress as a child.
Sure.
And the fear to be in that moment, to be the one changing history. And there's no, we have the sign to the Charlottesville 12, but I'd love to see more celebrating the children of the civil rights movement.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah. So maybe we'll see something like that. I don't know.
Then there's
let me ask you this. Because I have been told that the money has been offered to actually move them. That's so that the money is there to move them.
But
what if they were moved
by somebody
an independent source?
Okay.
What if they could move the statues to a Civil War battlefield?
Then that's the best thing to do. because there are plenty of Civil War battlefields that don't have Robert E. Lee or Stonewall Jackson statues. In fact, there are a number of Stonewall Jackson battlefields where he was in command in the Shenandoah Valley.
And no statues.
That would love, I'm sure, to have a statue. There are plenty of them.
That might be the more appropriate, lack of a better word, place for...
That's an appropriate place.
For something like that?
That's an appropriate place. Confederate cemeteries would be another.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then as you're doing tours of these battlefields, you've got the statue there, and you can talk about it. And you can talk about where the statue was originally.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
I'd like to see them stay, because I think they represent an incredible opportunity to teach people about the lost cause and about what was going on in the 1920s and why the statue went up in the first place.
Well, I saw the interview. I watched the interview that you did with Gary Gallagher, and that's what Gary said. And I think that's a really good idea. He uses them for that purpose.
Right. To teach the lost cause.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
But for the people who don't understand that, Lost cause is a myth. It's a myth.
Right. It's a myth.
Right.
Yeah. But people waving the Confederate flag today screaming you can't change history. And it's sad. That's how I feel. It's sad because that's someone who doesn't understand that the very history they're defending is revisionist history.
It is revisionist.
It's lost cause.
Lost cause is revisionism.
It's BS. It's a total myth.
It's revisionism. Yeah. But you can't explain that to those people. I remember you asked Gary what does he say to people who believe in that the war was fought over states' rights, and his answer was just classic. I've used it. He said that, well, you can believe that the Civil War was fought over states' rights if you don't read. You remember him saying that?
If you don't read. Yeah, it's true, though.
It is true.
But you get people that...
More and more with these issues, I'm just disappointed, and I see it as a failure of our educational system. I really do. I mean, it's 151 years ago that the war ended, and a large number of Americans believe that there is actually a debate over what the war was fought over. That just amazes me. How is that possible?
That's the lost cause at work.
That's right.
That
shows you the power. That's exactly
the people
what
who created the lost cause.
Very powerful.
That's what they wanted to do.
Very powerful.
They wanted to confuse people in the South.
And they did.
So that they would no longer think it was about slavery.
To save face.
To save face. To say, like, oh, no, we couldn't. There was no way we were fighting. It was a noble cause. Yeah.
Fighting for states' rights.
And Lee was such a good man.
It was a constitutional issue.
Yeah. In which it's got nothing to do with the fact whether Lee was a good man. It has zero to do with his character. Zero. And I think that's debatable because the guy sent hundreds of thousands of young boys and men to die in the hope that slavery would continue, in the hope that in the year 2016 in America, you would still have people of color who were enslaved. That was their dream, Rick.
Right.
That was the dream.
They're trying to
that
establish.
Forever there would be human slavery in America.
A slave republic is what they were trying to establish.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I want to ask you about those Confederates after the war because you know about this. And this will bring us back full circle to South America.
Okay.
And some people may not know that there were thousands, right? Not hundreds. Thousands of Confederates.
Confederados.
Who refused to live in America. And they
after the North won. Right.
After the North won. And they packed up and left.
Right.
And where did they go?
Well, a large number of them established a city in Brazil called Americanos, and there's a Confederate cemetery in Americanos, and they celebrate Confederate Memorial Day and fly battle flags.
They fly Confederate battle flags?
They absolutely do.
They have statuary, and they have
I don't know, their descendants are
still there?
I don't believe they have statuary. Yeah, the descendants are there, and, you know, all the last names are Southern last names.
That's amazing.
They're Anglo last names, but they haven't spoken English in generations.
They speak Portuguese.
They do, Portuguese, right.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
That would be a good movie, wouldn't it? Is that a documentary? I mean, somebody has had to have done a documentary about that. But there are also
ex-Confederates that went up the Amazon River and disappeared. So that I would argue that that's an even better movie.
Whoa! I haven't even heard of that.
That's like Heart of Darkness.
Yeah!
Yeah, yeah.
So tell me, what's the story?
So, right after the war, 1865, 1866, it's several dozen who were fairly well-to-do and refused to, like you said, refused to accept the conclusion of the war, went up the Amazon looking to found some kind of settlement and disappeared, and people lost track of them. But I know that years later, and this is the only other thing I know about this, so years later, another expedition went up the Amazon looking for these people and found natives with blonde hair and blue eyes. So obviously some of them survived and intermixed with the natives up the river, up the Amazon River.
Well, depending upon the who the people were, the natives were.
Right.
It's not likely they would have killed the children and the women.
Right.
They would have brought them, right. They would have brought them in.
That's true.
Into
That's
the tribe.
True. That's true. And then quite a few others went out into the world, men who had experience commanding soldiers in combat, mostly generals, but other officers too, went out and found work in other armies around the world. So a whole bunch of them went to Egypt, and there...
What? Really?
Uh-huh. And this would be an excellent documentary,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
A bunch of them went to Egypt, and the person, the name that comes to mind is the Khedive. The Khedive, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right. The Khedive hired them for his armies, and they fought, I'm not sure exactly who they were fighting against, but they fought out there in the Egyptian army for a while.
Wow.
A number of them went to Mexico. Actually, this would be an interesting article, wouldn't it? A number of them went to Mexico.
I mean, this is a book we're talking about, and maybe it's been written. I don't know.
It probably has been written.
But it's
ex-Confederates,
like,
yeah.
It's like this diaspora of the Confederacy. They went all over the world.
Confederates.
Yeah.
A number went and got hired by Emperor Maximilian in Mexico. The problem is his reign only lasted a short while afterwards. So
that's such a fascinating story.
That's a fascinating story.
I mean, that should be... That's got to be a movie, and I'm sure a book has been written about that too.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's any good. That is such a... Tell that story, because that is so... It's just such a... Most Americans have never heard of this.
Right.
That
well,
during the Civil
War... But they've heard of one aspect of it, Cinco de Mayo. They've heard, everybody here has heard of Cinco de Mayo because it involves beer.
Right.
So, France, looking at what was happening, and our nation was divided... We're fighting amongst ourselves, saw an opportunity to seize Mexico.
France, which had always had its eyes on North America, they were here before the British, long before the British. They'd had, you know, French Indian War. The French were here for a long, long time. They'd always wanted
and they'd gotten thrown
North
out.
America.
They'd gotten thrown out by the British.
Yeah, they always had their eyes on North America.
They
never gave up.
They did. And so they got an Austrian and his wife by the name of Maximilian, and I'll remember her name in a minute, but right now it doesn't come to mind. And they sent him down there supported by French troops and established an empire. In Mexico. Now, you know, we were pretty upset.
During the U.S. Civil War.
During the Civil War. Now, the Lincoln administration is pretty upset about that.
Of course
they are.
But they
can't do anything about it. I mean, you know, we've got the Monroe Doctrine, and they're upset, but what is he going to do?
His troops are engaged in other matters
at the
moment.
Basically, France is snubbing its nose at Abraham Lincoln.
They put this empire right on the border while our Civil War is going on,
right.
Sort of rubbing their hands together saying, kill yourselves, we're ready to take over.
And on top of everything, they are semi-pro-Confederate. So there were goods that were coming into Maximilian's Mexico and then coming across the border into Texas illicitly.
From France.
From everywhere. Things were coming into Mexico and then across the Rio Grande into Texas and thereby into the Confederacy. So they're semi-pro-Confederate.
That's fascinating because I just did this interview last week with this guy who wrote a book about how France and Spain helped the American colonists win the Revolution.
Right.
Because they were, you know, they were fighting England.
And the Netherlands.
And the Dutch as well. And they wanted to see America separate from England because
Absolutely.
It served their... No, it served all their interests, financial interests,
well,
economic empire,
everything.
The enemy
of my enemy is my friend. The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
There you go.
Right. So
France has this empire. They're smuggling weapons in to help the Confederacy.
Now, meanwhile, inside of Mexico, a revolution is commenced, and that's what we're celebrating in Cinco de Mayo, is a victory, and I used to know the name of the battle. I'm not going to remember it. A victory over the French in Mexico by the revolutionaries.
By the natives.
That's
the Spanish natives.
Yeah, the Mexican revolutionaries. That's what Cinco de Mayo is a victory over the French, a French army.
And most Americans have no idea that a French army took over Mexico during the U.S. Civil War.
This would be well, people have made movies about this, but at the end of the American Civil War, the Johnson administration now, because Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, sent an army, and the figure that immediately comes to mind, of about 50,000, and it's almost all African-American troops, of the USCTs, the United States Colored Troops, to the Rio Grande. And the message is very clear. You know, if you need some help to throw the French out, we will cross the Rio Grande and help you throw the French out.
After we had just taken a lot of Mexico from them in the Mexican War in the 1840s,
A generation earlier.
Right.
But Maximilian's reign, they were able to overthrow Maximilian themselves without our help. But the message from the United States government is very clear.
Yeah.
We will march an army of 50,000 into Mexico.
What a story. France was ready to make a move, Rick.
They did make a move.
They were ready to make a move.
They did.
They were ready move troops into Texas.
They busted.
That's exactly what they were going to do.
They busted a move.
Yeah. They were coming up here.
While we were otherwise occupied.
So, you know what we were talking about how people just, they don't read the history. They don't know this stuff, and they don't care to know this stuff. Millions of Americans don't care.
It's sad.
Because it's more about how you feel about something, or you know some sketch of something. Like the guy waving the Confederate flag who thinks the Civil War wasn't fought about slavery.
Right.
Oh, it's not about slavery, it's about states' rights.
Because my grandfather told me that.
Yeah, my grandfather told me that, and he is convinced in his own mind that he's right and that everyone else is wrong. You take that and pull the camera way back, that's what's going on in America. That's our politics today. It's full of these millions of people who think they're 100% right. And if you don't agree with them, you don't just have a different viewpoint on it. You just don't know the facts.
Right.
That's what's going on.
It's sad.
And both sides.
It's upsetting. And I know you were thinking this, but I'm just going to go ahead and say it. And we know that guy who is flying that Confederate flag, we know who he voted for in the election.
Yeah. Yeah, that's of course he did.
Right.
And he's convinced that he's right about that, and everybody else has their eyes asleep, and they just don't understand what's really going on.
Right.
And he's got all the facts, and, you know, he reads all these alt-right blogs that have all these conspiracy theories.
And
he's got now his own president who tweets conspiracy theories in the middle of the night.
Right. And you and I are PC nutcases.
Because we read history.
That's right.
And we read original documents. And we read letters. And we're not afraid to quote Jefferson. It's worrisome.
It is
because
worrisome.
It makes you bring this back to Jefferson. And the whole idea that these guys had that it's a very Western idea that was the foundation of the Enlightenment. And it's what gave us the revolutions. American, France, and Russia. And then in the middle of the 19th century, all the revolutions, democratic revolutions across Europe, Greece,
Latin America,
Austria,
Latin America,
and then down in Latin America.
Right.
Yeah, they were. It was based on this basic belief that truth and facts and science and information should guide governments, and the government should represent those ideals and the interests of the people, not old money. Principalities, kingdoms, armies.
Right.
That's the way they did it in the Middle Ages.
That's right.
This was a new idea that was the very foundation of the Western Enlightenment.
Right.
That human beings are born with certain rights and we need to protect them.
Right.
And the truth does exist. There are facts. There is. And so that's why you get things like a free press. That's why you get things like public education, because they recognize in these societies people have to be literate. They have to be willing to go out and find facts. The facts have to be given to them. And this information, reason, critical thinking.
That's where we're falling down, right there, those last two. That knowledge, real knowledge, education, and critical thinking. That's where we're falling down.
And you get to a point where people, and I always mention him because this is so applicable, but the Canadian media theorist Neil Postman, the book is Amusing Ourselves to Death. I always come back to that because that's the book people need to read. Because he wrote about this in 85 in his book. He said, we're getting to a place where we're redefining what it means to be well-informed. We're redefining what it means to process information and facts, and because when, people are picking their own facts.
And when he was
and
writing,
some of the facts aren't facts.
Right. When he was writing, what was he talking about?
He was specifically talking about television. Okay. And he was worried.
Television news?
Television news. He was worried that, he said, television is an entertainment medium.
Right.
So no matter what you put on television, it becomes entertainment.
Right.
And so he was worried that, he said this, that information, news that we rely on as citizens, not as consumers, but as citizens, by the mere fact that it's on television.
It's entertainment.
You know, the medium is the message.
Right.
He was a peer of Marshall McLuhan.
Right.
They were both from Canada. He said, this is, it becomes entertainment.
Right.
And if the information you're relying on to make the decisions you need to make as a citizen who supposedly controls power in your constitutional democracy, if that information you're relying on becomes entertainment, then it's a farce.
Right.
So then the whole foundational idea at the foundation of the Western Enlightenment, that's to me the scariest point where we are now. Because then you can do anything you want with facts. You can do anything you want with ideals. Then you can tell someone, hey, freedom is being in a cell. That's how we've defined it. You can change the definition of things if facts no longer really are facts. They're just opinions. Mm. I mean, and that's what fascist governments do.
That's right.
Hannah Arendt wrote about this, fascist governments in Italy and Germany in the 30s. She said the greatest thing they ever did is they convinced people that a statement of fact was just a statement of opinion. That's the power of fascism. Because then, what do you believe? Well, then you're back in Orwell at the end of 1984, right, when 2 plus 2 equals 5.
Right.
2 plus 2 equals 5 because I say it does.
Right.
That's what power says in 1984.
Right.
And it's not about truth. It's about what power says.
Speaking of fascism, my wife and I, we were in Buenos Aires for a week, and they've got a beautiful cemetery down there right in the middle of the city. It's called Recoleta, and it's actually a necropolis because it's filled with mausoleums. So it's actually a city of the dead.
Wow.
With regular streets in it.
Oh my gosh.
The statuary, some of the photographs we took are just unbelievable. But we went to visit Evita Perón there. And while we were standing there and looking at her tomb, we had two or three different groups come by with tour guides. And one was in Spanish, and it was for little kids. They were 8 or 10 years old. And I was fascinated to hear how the Argentine tour guide described a fascist to the kids. And it was pretty upsetting. She was a hero of the nation. And then another group came by of French.
Talk about veneration and celebration.
Yes, French speakers. And then there was another group of Germans that came through, but she is the most famous. I mean, this place must cover probably 20 acres. I mean, it's huge.
But it's known as the cemetery where Evita Perón is.
Oh, she is the most famous person there. So, you know, when you look on the map, you know, she's marked. I mean, because everybody
crosses my mind to sort of connect these dots we've been talking about?
What's that?
100 years from now, 200 years from now, Donald Trump. We could have tour groups around his gravesite, and he could be treated the same way. What a great leader, El Duque. You know, I mean, just the leader. We don't know. We don't know because we are at a scary time where people make up facts, and people believe them. They just believe them
because they don't read.
Or they're reading these websites.
Right.
Maybe they are reading.
Or they're reading in echo chambers where all they're getting is what they want to believe.
It's conspiracy theories. And, you know, Hillary Clinton drinks the blood of infants. I mean, this is the kind of crazy stuff. It's really, that's to me the most upsetting thing about where we are now. We are at a precipice in a way of the Western Enlightenment in Western history. It's so much bigger than just, oh, well, I don't like Donald Trump. Because if a guy like that can run for office and win in America, say the things he said, be such an obvious to me,
right,
and to, you know, millions of Americans, an obvious scam artist.
Right. A narcissist.
If he can win and take the most powerful position in the entire world.
Right.
We're not in Kansas anymore. this is truly a frightening moment for us.
Yeah,
and not just for us as a people, but for everything that we like to say we believe in the West. Constitutional democracy, justice, equal justice, public education, a free press. All these ideals that we like to say we believe in and that make us who we are. Now they're all at play. They're all in play. Because who knows how this will redefine those things for the future. Because definitions change. Democracy doesn't mean the same thing in 2016 that it meant in 1776. A free press doesn't mean the same thing.
Right.
Public education doesn't mean the same thing.
Right.
These evolve. These ideas and ideals evolve. They right. change. How will they change now? That's the scariest thing.
Well,
and
yes,
we can get to a point where freedom means being behind a wall or bars. It absolutely could happen.
That's an incredibly bleak picture.
With a pretty poster of Rio on your jail cell, you know?
Wow.
I don't know.
Wow.
So what are you doing this week? What's your next movie? What's your next movie after Hacksaw Ridge, which you loved?
What was the movie that you described, Allied?
Allied is good.
Yeah, I want to go see that.
It was a really good movie. I really liked it.
But I'm in this big in-between place where I'm talking now with people and starting a whole bunch of projects. So I'm in...
Good. That's exciting.
It is an exciting time. You know about that.
Where you're just running down spinning plates.
Things end. Yeah, things end and a whole bunch of things are about to start. And, yeah.
It's exciting.
Yeah, it is exciting.
Good. I'm excited for you. Rick Britton, you can find him online at rickbritton.com. Make sure you pick up a copy of one of his fantastic award-winning books, including Jefferson, a Monticello Sampler, which is one I heartily recommend.
Thanks.
But it's not the most recent.
No, Virginia Vignettes.
Virginia Vignettes is the most recent. And you can get all that information. Rick Britton, cartographer, historian, lecturer, and author at rickbritton.com. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.